EMF? EMF, we are back. We are back with Lightning Talks. I am Thor, god of Lightning Talks. We've never been in Stage B. It's very exciting. We've been promoted. Those lights are really bright. We have another slam schedule, so we are going to get straight on with it. Here is James.
Hello. Do my slides come up on the screen? Not yet. Not yet. Okay. Yeah, there we go. Right. I don't have long or I'm going to get hit with a hammer. So I'm James. I'm going to talk about a weird space mystery that I like. I'm going to talk about a project called VASCO. This is the Vanishing and Appearing Stars Across a Century of Observations project. It was a citizen science project led by someone called Dr. Beatrice Villarreal. And essentially the idea is to look at old sky surveys and look at new sky surveys and see what's not there. Have any stars exploded or disappeared or whatever? What's changed over a century? So it compares lots of sky surveys. And on the slides, there are all the papers, links to the papers for this stuff. So they did that. They did the Citizen Science Project. And over the course of doing that, they found lots of things that had, you know, were interesting between different surveys. But then they noticed that there were things that were in one set of images in one survey and not in the image taken an hour later. Particularly POS1. This is the Palomar Observatory Sky Survey, takes two plates, takes a red exposure and a blue exposure. They're about an hour apart, roughly. There are actually times on there. Yeah, about an hour apart. And they found something interesting. They found that there were some star-like objects in one that weren't in the other. And you can see them, there's sort of three blobs there, and they're not in the second picture. So, what are these things? They ran a whole load of image analysis across that whole data set. They found almost 300,000 of these transients. They're not, they ruled out things like plate defects, cosmic rays hitting the plate, things like that, because those look different. The elongated one there is an asteroid. And interestingly, they found a deficit of transients inside the Earth's shadow. So, and the statistical significance of that was 17 to 22 sigma. If, I think 5 sigma is the confidence they wanted to get to for the Higgs boson. So this is very, very improbable that these things weren't there in the shadow. So that's odd. But you look at the sky and there's, you know, starlinks, and there's all sorts of weird stuff up there, right? So that's not unusual. We filter all this crap out. But they looked at these things and said, well, what do they look like? They look like stars, and they say, okay, these are consistent with what they say, fast reflections of high albedo objects in geosynchronous orbits around Earth, which is a lot like iridium flares, or they're not geosynchronous, but you get the idea. Or the ISS pass, which is happening at 10 o'clock tonight. You can see it. And all the bloody starlinks. And they modelled all these shapes to try and get the sort of predicted idea of what they might look like. So that's fine. There's only one problem. POS1 was taken in 1952. And we didn't launch Sputnik until 57. We didn't have anything. We didn't have any artificial satellites in 1952. So what are these things that are... Oh, I'll come back to that. So, obviously that's one paper. Somebody has now replicated this, looking at a different set of plates from different observatory in Hamburg. And the fun thing about this one is that the telescope has known optical distortion. So it needs glasses. And they looked at the transients they found for that one. Oh, okay. And it had the same distortion. Therefore, it's real light, not plate artifacts. Something is there. Then they did some fun things. They found significant correlations with nuclear testing and UFO sightings, which is obviously where it all gets crazy. And there's that deficit in the shadow is weird. So it's a mystery. This is science at its best. They went looking for one thing and they found something else. And we tend to only look for things we want to find. So what happens when we turn off the filters? What do we see?
All right. right. Thank you, James. Next up, we have got Ava.
Hello. Yes, hi, I'm Ava from Glasgow Hackerspace. I'm going to talk... Oh, thank you, thank you. I'm going to talk about how to start a hackerspace. I didn't think that I would ever do that, and I ended up doing it, and I'm still surprised. There's my actual first slide. Okay, yes, I'm Ava from Glasgow Hackerspace. I'm going to largely go off of my notes rather than the slides, and then I'll kind of go through them at the end. How did I start? So I basically put out a call for participation that mostly looked like creating a Discord server. Sadly, Discord is the most accessible thing, and you really just want to try and get as many people in as possible. We also did some outreach on a local subreddit, and we just sort of pulled people in for a public meeting, tried to gauge some interest, talked about what we'd all like to see in a hackerspace, and it kind of went from there. The next sort of like key thing for me was to build a small team of committed people who really want to see it happen and will put in the work. It is a lot of work. There's just like so much thinking and paperwork, especially in the UK, of like getting everything together, and a lot of just like, well, you'll waste a lot of time probably if you try to do this. So yes, also a key with respect to burnout, like you will probably burn out, but if you have multiple people, you can kind of like cue the burnouts so you're not all burnt out at the same time, and then one person can continue carrying the torch whilst others are burnt out. I'm going to say some UK-specific stuff. We should have made a company sooner rather than later. We incorporated as a CIC, which is sort of just before a charity. That was a mistake. You will, again, like totally make mistakes. That is fine. But don't incorporate a hackerspace as a CIC. After that, we put out a call for fundraising. So just within the Discord server, again on Reddit, tried to get cash pulled together. We ended up with about $3,000 in the bank, which is awesome. And that was enough to get going. We reached out to art spaces. So we ended up founding our space, which I will slide. This is the first edition of the space. We are located inside artist studios, which means we get really cheap rent. And we basically started not being profitable, but net positive every month within like immediately, basically. And yes, other than that, more advice is like grow slowly. I'm purposefully omitting a lot of stuff because I only have 5 minutes. But if you are curious, stop by the Glasgow Hackerspace Village. I would be more than happy to talk about it. Otherwise, check out our website and you can contact us through there. You'll find out a way to talk to me. I am 100% sure of that. I'm going to quickly run through the rest of the slides. Yes, this is our door. It would have been very nice to be on street level, but sadly, that was not really an option for us. Then we sort of started slowly filling out the space. This is more what it looks like at the moment. The shark went up first. Also very important. Yeah, I think that is the last of my slides. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ava. Next up, we have got Edward.
Hello, I'm Edward. This is my house. Well, one of these is my house. On the top, there's a solar water heater panel for heating my hot water. There's the, you can't actually see mine very well, but here's one of my neighbors you can see from my roof terrace that I took during sunset. There's a cylinder. There's my hot water cylinder. The water from the gets heated by the solar water panel. Another view of the cylinder. There's a pump. There's a controller. There's a controller. There's a pump. This is an extra controller for, there's an electrical system as well. In the winter, it don't get enough sunlight, so you want to be able to heat the water in the winter. It's just around a corner. You can see like a little bit of blue. It's difficult to get to, it's kind of annoying. There's my cylinder. So it broke one day. There's the controller, red light, and it said there's a fault. The sensor on the roof isn't working, so no more hot water. So I have to just use electric. So I stuck a finger bot on the boost button on my on my controller. Here's another view of the Fingerbot. So this I can control remotely from Home Assistant, like home automation. I heat the water overnight, but then anytime I want hot water, here's my Home Assistant. And then I've got a boost system that I compress it, and it goes through the stages, so I can say, you know, 30 minutes, 60 minutes, 120. But that's terrible. So I got a guy in to look at it, and he said, I can't go on the roof. And then he said, oh, no, I can go on the roof. It's fine. So he went on the roof. There's my cylinder. And he said, I can't fix it. The part's obsolete. Nothing I can do. So I bought my own ladder. There's my ladder. And I went up on the roof. I've got an amazing view from the roof. There's some solar panels. There's my panel. There's some stuff. I pulled the sensor out. It was wired up like this, not very waterproof. So then I wired it directly into the thing, and found out that the reason it wasn't working is that there's a break in a cable on the top of the roof. So I cut the cable, I changed the connectors, and now I've got solar water heating again. Look, it's green. It says 46 degrees. Yeah, I've got hot water. The only problem is it's not waterproof. So I need to make it waterproof. Now it's waterproof. So that's how I fixed my solar water heater. There we go.
People are running under. I love it. This makes this all a little more leisurely. Next up, Julian. Julian, are you going to be wearing the mask?
Yeah, no, I'm not putting it on.
Okay, because handheld mic. Not sure how that's going to work. I can hold it.
Okay. No, I'll be fine. Yeah. No, I'll be fine. Is it started yet? Okay. Haven't seen anything yet. I'm just going backwards, am I?
Big one.
Yeah, okay. Yep. Right, here we go. Yay! Starting. Okay. So, this is part two of a talk I gave at a hacker camp last year. About how I, from knowing nothing, became a furry from playing far too much VR chat one night after being a normal VR developer for years and years and years and being quite old. But I left out an important part of the story. And the thing about breaking hearts is they're kind of like designed to be broken. And you kind of pick them up, put them back together, and they're often more beautiful and more interesting than they were before they were broken. So the little clue I left in the previous talk about my furry adventure online was this little line in here where I posited a moment in VR that I had, at this point, the happiest hour of my life. And I wasn't exaggerating, and I'm not kind of like, I'm old enough to know what I'm talking about. And the problem is, when I tell this story to most friends, is they put themselves into the story and say how they don't like VR, and it kind of makes them sick and so forth, and they completely missed what I've just said, you see? So what happened to make this occur was about 4 months before, they have a set of new nights just for like beginners who are probably a bit shy and don't know anyone, and then they kind of ignore you for 2 hours, and eventually after a while, a couple of us found each other, having not talked to anyone, and we sat around in a little circle right in the right-hand side. I met a couple of new people that way, and that was pretty much it, except the following week, I completely lost it over one of them. And to describe what this felt like, it was like someone in the middle of the night had drilled a wire right into the middle of my brain, and every time I thought about him or saw him online, 50 volts would just go straight in there, and I'd erupt in pleasure, or I'd be walking on air, or my heart would be kicked by a mule or something like that. So one thing or another. And it was quite astounding, because I knew exactly how much information I knew about them. Nothing. It was a few triangles and pixels one night. No micro expressions or smell or anything. So this is weird. Now, the thing about people is we're all unique and individual, but our sort of mental conditions are not. And after a while, I did find out what was going on. Was a guy who's written some articles, and he has a website describing this condition. And this one's not so fun to read, because it's like reading Alcoholics Anonymous, people trying to recover from this affliction. If you really want to know about it, you should go back to this original research, which is a lovely book. And the great thing about it is that if you've had a limerence, then every every story and it makes perfect sense. If you haven't, you just can't understand why people can't pull themselves together. You know, what's going on here? So, and the thing about with your brain breaking like this is you get to see all the parts and take the machine apart a little bit. And pretty much what's going on is your heart or your sort of feelings are like the health bar mechanic in a game. Quite complex with little levels that go up and down and cool off periods and stuff. And sometimes there's a sort of a tactic that you need to do in these games where you're on top of a platform, you see some health giving life on the other side, and you're going to have to take a fall and get hurt, maybe cross some place you don't know about in order to get there. And if you try and live life without getting hurt at all, you're never going to get off the platform. You're going to play it safe and nothing good's going to happen. So after about 8 months of this thing dying down over a period, I eventually got to know the guy. As I got to know him more, the limerence declined until it was down to zero, until we were having a pretty good time with each other. But I had still had this secret from him, so I had to one day tell the secret. So I decided to do it rather spectacularly, and decided I don't do karaoke, but I found a karaoke song called "Wicked Game," and the words were like, "The world was on fire, no one could save me but you. What a wicked game you played, making me feel this way. No, I don't want to fall in love with you." I did a right old performance, and afterwards he completely freaked out. I'd done a really bad thing. I was feeling terrible afterwards, so and I owe myself to blame on that one. After a while, he made up and he sang it back to me to prove he'd got over it. But I couldn't believe I was that crazy. Anyway, here we go.
Thank you, Elliot. I once utterly destroyed Wicked Game in karaoke in front of a guy I really fancied. It was one of the worst nights of my life. Next up, Elliot.
Hello, hello, thank you. No slides, pirate. These are my observations on the psychologies of standard note-taking utilities. They're my monologue ramblings from the mind of an over-analytical professional engineer for your amusement, insight, and conversation. I'm not a comedian, I'm not a psychologist, I have no formal studies in this field yet. I've spent too many years capturing thoughts and notes and trying to best arrange them into the sensible formats for myself, for someone else, for the added variables that maybe they don't want to read them. And who are they anyway? So I'm a cataloguer and a poet. I'm a tech consultant. I do outdoor teaching, and I'm a STEM ambassador. So note-taking observations. This was captured on a plain text smartphone notepad utility, which syncs to my custom hosted server so that it's accessible anywhere in the world, if the Wi-Fi works. I don't want to be hassled by formatting and structure, and or for the record, any kind of automated paperclip assistant. I enjoy using PowerPoint as the default first tool, which annoys a lot of people. For me, it is the freedom and flexibility of having a clean sheet. PowerPoint is just a whiteboard. It's got ready-made objects for me to use, like primary school crafts. There are hints at my own rebellious mentality and my creativity, but maybe a hint of laziness in there. I have to admit, I love a spreadsheet. I like the structure, the blurring of being a blank canvas, but with programming. It's perfect for any indexing, sequencing, and restructuring of my thoughts, which represents my desire to arrange. I'm a big fan of the inbuilt heading sort function. The spreadsheet discussion recently with a colleague then led into talking about physical notepads. And I realized I love an A5 0.5mm gray dotted pad. It's structured, but it's abstract. I'm someone who likes a construct, but I don't like rigid boundaries. I'm a creative, but within definition. Plain paper is only good to me when I don't have a clear plan, and I tend to fold it in half, but I'm not sure why. Either A2 or A5. Lined paper causes unnecessary stress. the mismatch of inappropriate width, separation, colour, the definition. I'm finicky. Maybe I'm over-analytical, and I'm probably just a non-conformist. So by extension, there is further insight based on the specific choices of word processing software. But we'll save that for another day. I've had too many debates with colleagues working on projects, colleagues and friends, about markdown and formatters. LaTeX, anybody? Pronunciation? Which wiki engine? Maybe we just leave it all as markdown, or just plain text. So I enjoy having a toolbox. I enjoy the flexibility. I have my favorites that clearly point out nuances in my character, and you'll all have your own favorites. Maybe what we need is a new standard written in plain text RFC. It's a fun conversation. The choice of tools, physical or software, show more about you than you might think. So, on to writing my thesis and the RFC. Thank you.
Thank you, Elliot. Right, Kate, you're up.
Me?
Yeah, you.
I did the counting, it was great.
No, we're on to time. That's right, you can breathe. We can meet Ashley. There you go, clicky click. Up next, Kate.
It's big button, right? Big button, hell yeah. Right. I set up my alarm for 3 minutes and 30 seconds, so I'm going to talk really fast. Hi, in 2024, I had a brief moment at EMF, but the most of the spent of the time dealing with breast cancer. Cancer is weird. I am weird. I am non-binary. Cancer is weird. You get the two of them combining, it's even frickin' weirder. But you know what? The fastest way to gender-confirming surgery on the NHS? It's cancer. Oh no, you're gonna take away my breasts. Oh God, how could you? Yes. Now you are allowed to feel the way that you feel. You are allowed to go, yeah, whatever, take them away, do what you like. And then if anybody reacts badly to how you feel, you call them out. I had a nurse who just got pissier and pissier by the fact that I wasn't responding appropriately. So I finally just said, hey, am I not responding appropriately? Do you expect me to be crying or something? And she just looked even more upset, but appalled as well. It was great. You can totally shave your head. It's freaking awesome. You will sweat a lot. You will not realize how much you sweat, but my God, it feels so good. And if anybody goes, oh, you're so brave, hell with them. But do not forget your wig voucher. Oh my God. They give you around 75 quid. And you don't have to get the super fancy fake real hair, whatever looks just like you, looks really boring. You can go to any beauty supply place, spend 10 pounds a wig, that gives you 7 damn wigs. Go nuts, get all the wigs. You will discover a distaste for body horror. This is unfortunate. You will like, I love David Cronenberg movies. And then you watch another one and you're like, no, I can't do this anymore. Did you know that if you pull out a drain by accident, it screams at you? God, ugh. And things that sound extremely scary usually aren't. And things that sound like nothing are really scary. There's a difference between fat necrosis, which is fine, and jaw necrosis, which is terrible. But you know what? Cancer is drag. Cancer is a drag. So take advantage of it. They say, oh yeah, you can have to sit down at a show. Go sit down at a show. Your neighbors are talking right outside your house really loudly and being really annoying. You can go, hi, I'm sorry, the chemo's really bad right now. Can you guys just be quiet? And they will all look so appalled, and then they'll stop talking, and then all of a sudden the bratty children aren't doing anything. It's amazing. Take advantage of the fact that you are ill and make sure that everybody does everything for you. You can get through this. I am getting through this. You can all get through this. It's okay. The NHS is really good at this. So that's me. You can find me. You can find me on Blue Sky. And if you're in Hull at the end of the month, go find me. Because also, I'm a drag king. So, hey. Come at me. Holy smokes, I actually have 9 seconds left.
You do. You're all so fast. You're putting the lightning in lightning. Next up is Robert talking about time travel. So, Robert, if you want to just, like, send us back in time and give the first four speakers, like, 10% more time, that would be good.
Hey, you can put the laptop on the ground.
That's it. We're good. Hello. So I'd like to talk to you about time travel, freedom, adventure, and the joy of owning and maintaining a classic car. This is my first time at EMF. I've met so many creators, free thinkers, and most importantly, people that think outside the box. You're all fixers, you all create, you all repair, you like to dismantle and then rebuild. So it made me ask, why is the car park not full of classic cars? Classic cars to me are a passion. They're lovely things, but more than that, they're a gateway to time travel, adventure, and community. Let's talk about time travel. When you're operating a classic car, and I use the word operate deliberately, it's a machine. You're using controls, you're feeling the weight of things, you're making decisions and enjoying a view from 50 or 60 years ago, exactly as it would have been then. You're experiencing an object drawn on paper, built by hands, not assembled by robots. Every trip becomes an adventure. Even the most pedestrian vehicles from the 50s, 60s, and 70s have beautiful details. Something gone from cars today, replaced by screens and fake sounds. The school run, or just going to the shops, becomes rich, not a chore. Not time to give up and get through, but time to cherish. And you'll notice how people treat you out on the road and in the world. They'll let you out of junctions, stop if you break down and offer help, ask you about it at petrol stations, and tell you their mum had one when they grew up. It's a gateway to stories and the best of people. It gives them something as well as you. You're putting colour, nostalgia, and beauty into the world. I'll just talk through some of the pictures on there. So there's an old Land Rover. So I pulled that out of a barn where it had been sat for 5 years, got it back on the road, and we've been on loads of adventures with it, green laning, so you can escape into the countryside, and there's loads of green lanes local to you, and it's just a beautiful escape. There's a car with a smashed front in the middle, and above it is the top. So that is a car I bought 7 years ago with no information, no paperwork. I knew nothing about the history of it, and all of a sudden I got a message on Instagram from the previous owner's son, who'd had it from the 70s. And all of a sudden, I got all these stories, all these pictures, all the history of it, which was wonderful. The little white car there, that was a car I paid £600 for at uni and rebuilt with my dad, so it's full of memories. And the top picture with all the cars parked up, that's what we called a Unit 10 car club. Like, me and my friends got together and just put on some events for us and just, you know, had a good time. Of course, there's maintenance, but there is joy in repairing and knowing your vehicle. It becomes part of you, an extension. They're so easy to work on too. So much more simple than you'd think. Just nuts and bolts. And the workshop manuals themselves are a joy to read and look at. As you use it, you learn the signs of it going wrong. It'll become a living object to you, a companion. You'll know what it needs before it needs it, and you'll fix it before it fails. If it fails, it's a story. It's part of the adventure. Eventually, though, it won't break down anymore. You'll have changed or rebuilt it, and it'll thank you by never letting you down again. You'll get bolder and go further. This is also the definition of right to repair. They're green, too. Carbon long offset and keeping another new car off the road. Insurance is cheap, tax is free, and you don't even have to MOT them if you stay on top of them. Plus, when you look after them and improve them, their value goes up or at least offsets what you've put in. I encourage you and urge you to look at eBay or Car and Classic to see what's out there and pique your interest. I'd recommend starting to look at Triumphs as a kickoff point. The world is full of people that will help you, friends you'll make, and stories that you'll create. This isn't just about nostalgia. It's about living with purpose and intention, milking every drop out of every journey, choosing maintenance over disposability, and keeping a piece of history alive. Go forth and time travel. Thank you.
Should we have one more? Mark, bring us home.
Next one. Is the next one? There we go. I didn't know I was called Sleepy Entropy. That's fun. So this is Pimp My Reservoir, a quick guide for the would-be water company executive. And a bit of, I don't know, one of my more vague, like, autistic interests over the past several years. So, why would you actually want to build a reservoir? There's several reasons. You might have too much spare money. You might have a valley lying around, as that's what reservoirs are built around. You might be really thirsty, like most of us have been today. And you also might want to annoy the Welsh. More on this later. Wrong way. If I hold it upside, not upside down, it would be better. So, what do you need to build your delightful reservoir that you want to make? Dam. It prevents all your hard-earned water from escaping. Kind of important if you you want a reservoir, you need to hold the water in. You can kind of walk across them sometimes. That's kind of fun, and they still need to let some amount of the water out in a controlled manner, because otherwise your reservoir will flood. So, you know, there's a big kind of concrete look that a lot of people think about. There's a sort of lots of grass and gravel look that other places have. This is in Wales. And then there's the quite lovely look that you get at other places, often like late Victorian era. But you want to drink the water, right? Because, like, what's the use in the whole reservoir of water if you can't drink it? So you need a draw-off tower. Allow you to get the water out. They're generally off to the side, and they should kind of be relatively easily serviceable. Some look quite nice. Again, Lake Fernwee, quite gorgeous there. Others really kind of don't, and kind of veer into the arguably kind of phallic territory. Reservoir's flooding. You need a spillway. If it rains too much, your water can actually get out. And they're really good for attracting dumb tourists. I'll show you this in a second. I guess they kind of look like a bit of a fun or scary water slide. So some, you know, a big chute like that one, big water slide. Others are really quite horrible. Like, what on earth is that? I've read papers talking about scary architecture that mention this in particular. This is a bell mouth, and it's in Derbyshire. Sorry, don't know how to use a microphone. And that's in the US, Lake Bereasea, and that is even more horrible. And yes, there will every so often be a stupid paddleboarder on the news who decides to get a bit too close and spark a local outcry. Bonus features. You've got your base things. What should I add extra? Recreation activities. They're always good fun. Make a bit more of that money. Cute walks and bird watching. Hydroelectric power. It's quite fun. Can generate electricity and earn more money, but they're rather scary and big to maintain. Fun. Drowned villages. A lot of reservoirs are built on valleys. Generally, valleys have people living in them, and occasionally, you know, you might need to use power and influence to get rid of them first. But, you know, you've got money, remember, so it's okay. Even better, evicted Welsh farmers. Sometimes the drowned village just isn't enough. You could perhaps anger the Welsh public and evict a normal village just so your faraway city can drink water. Shout out to Liverpool, who did this twice in about 90 years. Bonus points if your construction site is blown up by an angry militant Welshman. Again, many stories. These are snaps that I took myself. So, a few holiday photos of my kind of reservoir adventures. I don't actually remember where this was. Actually, yeah, Lake Fernwee. Okay, cool. This was in Llynkellyn in Wales. This was another one of those drowned villages. There's a lovely chapel next door where all of the old gravestones were relocated to. And actually, just downstream from this, there is some of those fun recreational activities. You can go whitewater rafting and have a fun time. So, that's about it. I hope you like my holiday snaps, and enjoy the world of reservoirs. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Mark. That is the end of our EMF program of Lightning Talks for this year. Stage B, give a big hand for our speakers. You heard James. You heard Ava. You heard Edward. You heard Julian. You heard Elliot. You heard Kate. You heard Robert. And you heard Mark. If you've so you see how much fun this is, right? If you've never done a lightning talk before, I sincerely recommend that you give it a shot. It is such a fabulous way to just come up and share your passion, get used to public speaking and that kind of thing. So do consider submitting something for next year. 28, God, time goes by, right? But yeah, for the last time, thank you, EMF. I've been Thor.